And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. And we have on the line with us today Professor Emeritus Alan Nasser. He's a Professor Emeritus at Evergreen State College in Political Economy and Philosophy, and the author of the upcoming United States of Emergency, American Capitalism and Its Crises. We'll be hearing more about that. But Alan, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I got to say, your article in Counterpunch the other week caught my eye. This was from August 28, and the title of the article is "The Myth of the Middle Class. Have Most Americans Always Been Poor?" And I really love that you came out with this because, you know, we've got another election campaign coming up in the United States. There's already one in Canada. And we're going to be hearing all over and over again this mantra about how the middle class is shrinking. We all need to protect and shore up the middle class, and that this party will be the one that, you know, supports the middle class and so on, which it's something that we're all part of, apparently. But you argue in the article that the size and influence of the middle class is largely exaggerated and part of a sort of myth of a stable and prosperous America. I just wanted to take a quote that you referred to in the article. You referred to President Obama's statement on Letterman, where he said that middle class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead. That's an example of this middle class mythology. So the key idea is if you work hard, you can have a comfortable standard of living. Now, you tried to counter and challenge this mythology. And one of the ways you did that was you took us on a bit of a historical journey. And I would say it started in your article referencing the 1920s, which you said was the first preview, I guess, a preview of a consumer society in the United States. So I'm just wondering, what can you tell us about the 1920s? What was particular about it as a preview consumer society, and in what ways was it similar to the society that we have today?
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, my treatment of the 19, or what I revealed about the 1920s, you know, it's also making an implicit reference to President Obama's remark on Letterman, which suggests, and all talk about the middle class in America suggests, that if you work hard, if you're willing to work and you work hard, you will earn a wage that is sufficient to provide you with a reasonably comfortable, adequate standard of living. And one of the things that the that's evident in an examination of the 1920s is that many Americans worked hard and they earned a wage, but that wage was nowhere near sufficient to provide them with a comfortable a standard of living. And then I go on in the article and at greater length in my book to show that it's never been the case that Americans received a or enjoyed a comfortable standard of living as a reward for their hard work. Something else was needed to provide that, namely not just debt. Not just working class people needing to go into debt, but cumulative debt. The debt burden for working class people has, you know, had to rise as a percentage of disposable income in order just to stay put, much less achieve a higher standard of living. And that was as true in the post-war period as it was in the 1920s.
I mean, the 1920s was an exciting period. It was called the Roaring Twenties, I believe. You know, World War I had ended. Men were back in their home countries, including the United States and Canada. And they had to find jobs. And and wage labor was how people made an income. But as you point out in your article, there was enormous consumer demand after the war for various items, radios and things like that. In fact, I remember in high school history class, they taught us that people went into debt in order to get a new radio. It was almost as like buying a new tractor or an extension on the house. They'd put down a lot of money, they'd go into debt in order to purchase these kind of items. So people wanted things. They wanted things that would improve their standard of living, but they had to rely on credit in order to expand their material wealth.
Yes, they did. The growth of the 1920s was really fueled by consumer expenditures for what economists call consumer durable goods, which are automobiles, radios, ranges, fans, electric fans, refrigerators, phonographs, this kind of thing that we take to be a staple of everyday life. And it was the demand for that kind of good, particularly the demand for the automobile. I mean, the expansion of the automobile industry was really the principal driver of economic growth and employment in the 1920s. This is the first time that the United States or the first time that the world had ever seen what we could call a consumer society. I would just add as a parenthetical point that this was the first time in American history that economic growth was driven by consumption demand and not by investment. I mean, by 1911, the country was industrially mature, and investment demand was not what was required to keep the economy going. It was to be consumer demand. In classical political economy, what the classical political economists believed was that after an industrializing economy, by definition, industrializing, it becomes industrialized. It reaches industrial maturity, where the rate of expansion of the means of production slows down dramatically. And they imagined that the profit rate would then decline in the capital goods industry, in the industry that produces things like railroads and steel mills, and that that would produce an income shift to labor, away from capital and toward labor. Labor's wages would then rise, and then the spending of those wages would fuel the further development of the economy. Well, that never happened. There wasn't a shift. There wasn't a shift of income to labor. Capital doesn't like that, and the way in which consumption demand was sustained then was by workers mortgaging their future income, by workers going into debt to boost their purchasing power and to enable them to have that middle class standard of living. Well, in the 1920s, wages were relatively stagnant. Wages were the same in 1929 as they were in 1922. I think that's, largely because the union movement was as weak as it's ever been. I mean, the union movement was extraordinarily weak. I wouldn't say non-existent, but kind of close to non-existent in the 1920s. And without organized labor to push wages up to match productivity increases, you had stagnant wages, skyrocketing productivity, skyrocketing production, and you had a shift of income from labor to capital. I mean, inequality was spectacular in the 1920s.
Right. So that was another major feature of your article, in that looking at the 1920s, when you talk about the United States, you're not looking at an overwhelmingly middle class society. Rather, you're looking at one that has become stratified. So people, they're working, they're struggling to keep up, they're seeing less and less income from harder and harder work or greater and greater productivity. So they're falling behind, using debt to catch up. But business owners, owners of capital, so their share of the national income increased. So that would have produced a dramatic difference in wealth.
Oh, yes. That happened in the 1920s. And then it happened again in the period after the so-called Golden Age, which was from 1949 to 1973. That was the longest period in American history where you didn't have a severe economic downturn, and you had relatively robust rates of growth, and presumably a thriving middle class. The standard story that's told there is that, you know, back in those days when we had a thriving middle class in the Golden Age, you had one breadwinner of the family. It was usually the male. It was almost always a man who was able to, provide for a family of four, provide education for the kids, provide health care for the family, save for retirement, purchase an automobile, purchase a home, all on the income of one breadwinner. Well, I mean, that story is just a standard myth, and it isn't true. The fact of the matter is that what was required in addition was, you know, increasing supplement of the wage income by debt, so that debt came to be what I did in my book was I examined household debt in every 5-year period since the end of the Second World War, so from 45 to 50, 50 to 55, 55 to 60, and so on, right through the rest of the century. And what you find is that in each five-year period, the ratio of debt to household disposable income increases. So you get to the point, of course, where the debt is unsustainable, and where debts have mounted to the point where they simply can't be repaid. Now, this had to happen in the 20s because income was stagnant and debts kept mounting, and to the point where, you know, if income is stagnant and debt comes mounting, there comes debt saturation. I mean, households simply don't have the income to pay off their debts, and that's part of the explanation of the depression of the 1930s. I think everyone knows that in the post-war period, the crisis of 2007 and 2008 was precisely the same kind of thing. I mean, mortgage debt and credit card debt and auto loan debt and student debt had mounted to the point where the payment flows were just not happening.
Yes, this is a very fascinating part later in your article where you look at the present day and make comparisons to that earlier period of consumerism, debt-driven consumerism in the 1920s. So you look at especially the post-Reagan period of 1980s, 1990s, especially 2000s. These are periods that resemble the 1920s in many ways, you know, the roaring 90s almost, because the union movement becomes weakened. Another historically weak period. So income gains are pushed back alongside other gains associated with the labor movement. Incomes stagnate. There's been remarkable stagnation in average incomes as well as the minimum wage itself since 1973. It's been like a 40-year wage freeze. And if you look at how American families try to keep up here, you know, they want to keep up their middle-class existence, right? You have to have that respectable middle-class existence with your house and the two-car garage and now a flat-screen TV, Blu-rays or Netflix, iPods, iPhones, iPads, all of these things. You have to have these to have that middle-class existence and so that you can send your kids to school with the right shoes, you know, so they don't get beat up and so on. So you got to have all these things. And the way this was fueled, once again, is through debt. I believe that you were showing that model has returned in full force.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It was fueled by debt, and it would never have happened. You would not have seen that. Without debt, you wouldn't have seen the Golden Age. And after the Golden Age was over, beginning in 1973, you started to see this tremendous divergence between wages and productivity increases. And the productivity increases were substantial, but wages were flat. And actually, I show in my book that if you measure the whole business correctly, actually there was actually a net decline in wages for 40 years, for almost 40 years. And the only way that the American worker in that 40-year period, beginning in the mid-70s, the only way that worker was able to avoid poverty, I mean, you know, serious poverty, was by, just like in the 20s, by accumulating mounting debt.
So not just to get a big TV then, but you're saying just to, you know, to have a house and feed the family, you have to take on debt.
You have to take on debt. And I think that it's worth mentioning that, I mean, many people will say, well, you know, people think that they have to have all these extra toys and they have to have the flat screen TV, they have to have all that stuff. You know, maybe if they, you know, persuaded themselves to forego those superfluous pleasures, they might, you know, the situation might not have developed as it did. But I don't think that's quite right. I think two things have to be said. Number one, consumerism is a deeply, deeply ingrained cultural phenomenon in the United States. When these new products come and, you know, more and more people buy them, you can't not avail yourself of these new pleasures. They're pushed very hard. The advertising campaign is spectacular. And Americans are promised a rising standard of living. And that's really measured quantitatively. It's about you know, purchasing consumer goods. So, I mean, that's very hard to resist. But even if it could be resisted, people, I think, ignore the incredible inflation in education, health care, and child care.
Costs,
and keeping up with those increases really was not possible on the wage that workers were making. And so I think another myth that has prevailed on the left, that the middle class was possible because unions were able to keep wages going up in line with productivity increases during the Golden Age. They were, but that wasn't sufficient. That wasn't sufficient to maintain the so-called middle-class standard of living. The increasing debt burden was a necessary condition for middle-class status.
Well, that's very interesting, because I think, you know, when we talk about this golden era, which was said to exist, you know, from 46 to 73 or so, you know, the post-war golden era. Yes, organized labor did make gains for a lot of workers that allowed them to participate in the rising standard of living. But, you know, those gains were spread out and not evenly. You pointed out in the article that, this rise in income for blue-collar workers, factory workers, wage workers, that was largely a unionized phenomenon. So non-union workers would not have been able to avail themselves as much from the wage increase, although they would have been affected by it. Then women were excluded because it was assumed that they would be conducting basically unpaid labor in the home. So they were in the domestic sphere and not included for the most part in the work sphere, except in terms of supplementing the household income in less stable and secure work. And then visible minorities, immigrants, were often excluded from the primary labor markets, the unionized labor markets. So you have lots of people in the United States who were not fully included in the rising standard of living or in getting a share of the productivity gains. So, Alan, you were making a contribution to this discussion here about the Golden Age, and you were suggesting that the Golden Age that was enjoyed by American workers or segments of American workers was not simply because of union wages or access to productivity gains. So you're saying that there are other factors that enabled Americans to flourish in some respects during that period.
Yes. There is the idea that lots of people on the left hold that the Golden Age was finally possible because of unionization, which forced workers to increase wages in line with productivity increases. And that really may have been a necessary condition for Golden Age alleged prosperity, but it was certainly not a sufficient condition. I think that if I can just give you the figures very, very briefly, what was also necessary was that from 1945 on, from the end of the war on, households had to increase their debt load cumulatively. I mean, if you, what I did from my book was I measured the ratio of households' debt to disposable income, which in 1946 was 24%. By 1950, it was 38%, 1955, 53%, 1960, 62%, 72% in 1965. And then by 1979, it was 77%, 1990, 88%, 1995, 95%. And finally, in 2007, the astonishing figure, you've never seen anything like this before, that household debt was 138% of disposable income. Well,
wow.
You know, that's debt that can't be paid, period. And, you know, as the great economist Michael Hudson puts it, puts it repeatedly in all of his work, and it should be repeated, debt that can't be repaid won't be repaid. And what happened between 2006 or so, when you started seeing leaks in the housing bubble, and September 2008, was that the debts that couldn't be repaid, in fact, weren't repaid, which meant that the securities that were composed of these debts were worthless. No one wanted to buy them. And, I mean, most people know the rest of the story. You had almost had a collapse of the whole global financial system because these securitized financial instruments that were made up of bad debts had been sold all over the world. And there's a very long story to be told here about the hazards of post-mature globalized capitalism, where the system is no longer propelled by the production of widgets, but it's propelled by finance. And that's a whole another different story, that we've really moved into a whole historically new phase of capitalist development where financial activity is principally what, and debt accumulation is what drives the economy.
Well, yeah, everything has become financialized. You know, someone working in a construction job, their salaries might be delayed because that money has been invested for short-term returns. You know, even the construction company is doing that. I think it might have been your article that talked about just how, the automobiles were actually extensively involved in financing arrangements as well back in the 1920s. So the incipient financialization of the economy that you might have seen in the 1920s has reached its full extent now.
Yes, that's a very good point. What you're referring to in the 1920s is when finally General Motors pulled ahead of Ford General Motors pulled ahead of Ford as the leading automaker, leading meaning the highest sales volume and highest profits. And they were able to do that because they established their own finance company, GMAC. And, the fact of the matter is that for quite a while before, I'm not quite sure for how long, it could have been for as many as 10 years or so or more, prior to the collapse of September 2008, General Motors was making more money off of its credit division than it was off of selling cars, which is, sort of a classic, beautiful expression of it's not so beautiful, it's actually ugly, but expression of the predominance of finance over production.
Wow. I mean, it sounds to me what you're describing is a situation where, America is, and much of the world isn't, is bubble economy, where they need bubble after bubble. And people are just sort of floating above that, propelled by some gases, insubstantial gases, through their own personal debt, which are not sustainable, which won't keep them afloat, So everyone's sort of at the top of the pond, just scrambling to stay up there.
Yes. Yeah. It's not a very pretty picture. The solution that Thomas Piketty puts forward in Capital in the 21st Century, which is the most widely read and discussed economics book of the last very many decades. It was number one on Amazon and sold out for a very long time. And he argues that the concentration of wealth into more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands is not a market in perfection. It's not a malfunction of capitalism. It's the way capitalism is supposed to work. And the result of that, of course, is inequality and a smaller and smaller group of obscenely wealthy people, but a much larger group of people who aren't doing very well at all. So you have inequality and poverty growing at the same time. How is that? I mean, how does a consumption-driven economy go on? Well, under those circumstances, well, it persists by households once again taking on debt to make ends meet, and we're finding now economists as prominent as Lawrence Summers and Paul Krugman, arguing that we might be in a period of perpetual secular stagnation where the economy can only be driven by promoting bubbles. And Krugman adds a negative interest rate, which really comes to charging consumers for saving money. You know, it's rather a dreadful situation. And the thing is that if bubbles are, you know, Summers points out that during the dot-com bubble, which was quite substantial, and during the housing bubble, which is the biggest bubble ever in human history, there's a tremendous, you know, by definition, huge bubbles inject a tremendous amount of liquid demand into the economy. However, growth rates were relatively sluggish during that whole period, and wages didn't go up. So even these bubbles were not sufficient to have the economy where we want it. So perhaps bigger bubbles are required, and Summers actually uses the word forever. We might be forever dependent on bubbles. What he doesn't mention is that means that we're forever dependent on bubbles bursting, and a series of, if the bubbles have to be bigger and bigger, then the devastating effects every time the bubble bursts on the real economy also have to be bigger and bigger.
Well,
it's a very, very bad. It portends social dislocation, intensification of the police state here in the United States, severe repression of working people, increases in suicide rates and domestic violence and psychological depression and crime. It's not a pretty picture, but now we have the most distinguished mainstream theorists telling us that that's what we may have to expect.
Yeah, a lot of words have re-entered the discussion: inequality, concentration of wealth. One of the ones that hasn't changed so much is middle class. And, you know, we'll get to that. It's funny because you have this stagnation in the economy in the United States, and companies are desperate to get that consumer demand rolling. I see many companies are now seeking, you know, Chinese markets, for example, that America's kind of tapped out. So let's go to China. Maybe they have an emerging middle class. Let's go there. So they're really, really desperately searching, you know, for middle class incomes and whatnot. But here in America, we hear how badly the middle class is doing, and that's what I wanted to end with. I mean, you've pointed out throughout your article, again, which is available on Counterpunch, August 28th, The Myth of the Middle Class: Have Most Americans Always Been Poor? That yes, most Americans have relied on wages to survive, and that the wages have not been sufficient to give the standard of living that is considered normal for the society. So there's been, you know, debt growth. There's been the creation of financial bubbles, massive financial disasters and collapse. So most Americans actually cannot really afford to have the two-car garage, the house, you know, the McMansion, the TVs, the iPod, the iPhone. It's not actually within their budget. And you have enormous stratification between these wage-dependent, debt-dependent earners and capitalists at the top who have become inheritors of a greater and greater share of the national income. So given that situation, why do you think that this term middle class is so prevalent or so popular and so widely used?
Well, I think what it does is it just disguises the fact that the middle class is really that other class that no one talks about. We always hear about middle class, and that implies logically that there's a class above it and a class below it. We have standard language now for the class above it. I mean, there's reference to to the 1%, and everybody knows that there are people who are not in the 1%, but are extremely wealthy. And I think most Americans are aware that there's, you know, considerable polarization, income and wealth polarization. So, you know, we talk about the class above the middle class, and we talk about the middle class, which is supposed to be vanishing, which I might add was one of Karl Marx's forecasts, that capitalism would ultimately bifurcate into a small, very wealthy class and a very large, impoverished class, which is also Piketty's point. I might also add that Marx thought that one of the things that would hasten this is automation. And this is one of the most widely discussed issues now, and I talk about it at some length in my book. These very prominent Oxford scholars on robotization are predicting that within 20 years, 47% of American jobs will be lost to automation and robots. Suppose they're half right. Suppose it's only 20%. That's really quite devastating. In any case, this kind of, you know, polarization has been forecast accurately, and things that no one talks about the class below the middle class. What about that class? Well, the fact is the class below the middle class is the middle class with credit and debt. If you stripped away the credit and debt, then the middle class would look like the class below the middle class, you know, the not very well at all, not very well off at all class. And I think the function, one of the functions of the term middle class is to disguise the fact that there is a very, very large and growing class of Americans who are barely able to make ends meet, and most of those people are the middle class, you know, what's mistakenly called the middle class. And if I might add, I mean, if we're not running out of time, I might just kind of add a point to something that you very shrewdly observed before, the idea of looking to China and, you know, customers for American business overseas. Obama appointed a jobs czar, Jeffrey Immelt, who's the CEO of General Electric. And this guy is supposed to be responsible for restoring jobs in America. Now, General Electric is a great outsourcer of jobs, which Obama, of course, did not tell the American people when he appointed Immelt. But Immelt has said, look, we've been criticized for outsourcing. And, you know, we're kind of trying not to do that. And, you know, sometimes we just have to do it. But the outsourcing that we are most interested in is not jobs, but customers. The customers are overseas. They're in the so-called emerging markets, not just China, but, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, China, and so on. Well, the emerging markets are not doing so well, as the recent market downturn shows us. I mean, much of what was behind that downturn was the lousy condition of government bonds in the so-called emerging economies. But the thing is that it appears that the administration, that the American elites have written off the working class as a market for U.S. production. They're looking for customers overseas. You know, Obama wants to get the economy going by increasing exports. That's the key to solve problems that we have now. Well, how do you increase export? Well, by depressing wages. By depressing wages, thereby depressing costs and giving us a price advantage in international markets.
Yes.
So, yeah, I hope that addresses your, to some degree, addresses your question.
Oh, more. Yeah, it does so and more. Yes, it's my understanding that in the United States and Canada, the biggest growth stores, you know, in terms of retail stores, are the dollar stores, the stores that sell things for a dollar. That companies like Sears or Eaton's that were to sell to that sort of illusory middle class, the sort of debt propped up working class, those stores are going out of business. They're disappearing. The malls are collapsing. The things that sold to this middle class, but things that sell to people that don't have that kind of disposable income, dollar stores, they're on the increase, as well as, you know, high end things. You know, you want to buy an Apple Watch for $8,000, that's on the upswing too. So those are the kinds of growth businesses now.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Brendan, is the U.S. press has been full of stories recently about the declining sales of dollar stores. Dollar stores are not doing very well.
Oh, no.
No, dollar stores, which is, Walmart's revenues have suffered some. Poor people can't even afford Walmart. And that the dollar stores are not doing well. This is maybe in the last 3 or 4 years, certainly, you know, since the crash of September 2008, is, to my mind, you know, very, very telling. I mean, if it means, I can't say with certainty that it means this, but it's not unreasonable to think that it means that people can't afford dollar stores. I mean, if we're in a situation where people can't afford dollar stores,
that is alarming. Yes.
It's alarming. It's quite alarming.
There you go. It sounds like you have a lot to talk about in this book. The debt-driven society, the stratification in America, how we got there, difficulties even during golden periods. It sounds like you're going to get involved in a debate there and probably cause economists to have something to talk about. So now look what you've done.
Well, I mean, that's a lot to ask for. I hope so. I mean, I hope my book will be out, you know, toward the end of winter or maybe early spring. And, I'm hoping it, you know, generates some discussion, some widespread discussion. I mean, I'm very fortunate in that since I've written the book, which talks a great deal about secular stagnation, automation, and robotization, those three concepts have re-entered mainstream vocabulary now. I mean, secular stagnation was talked about in the 30s, and then it was dropped after the Second World War. Now people like Gordon, Krugman, and Summers are talking about it. So I think that's it's bad for everyone, but it's good for my book because I talk about these same things, and what I write about won't seem eccentric and recherché.
Well, a lot of those things that you talk about, secular stagnation, a lot of these properties of the 1930s, they're not supposed to happen again. They're supposed to be behind us. Then I started hearing scary things during the millennium, that the economy would only go up and up and invest in the stock market because it can only go up. And then I started to get worried because I had heard that before. And it looks like we're seeing a replay of a lot of things. So I'm glad you noticed that and you've been writing about that and contributing to the discussion. So your upcoming book is it's called United States of Emergency, American Capitalism and Its Crises by Alan Nasser. I imagine that'll be popping up probably in the advertisement section on Counterpunch, you know, on the right-hand corner where they show the books. It'll probably be there too, right?
Yes. Yes, it will. And I believe it's already in, much to the embarrassment, I think, of these presses, because my book has been somewhat delayed. It's already in the catalog of the University of Chicago Press and of Pluto Press. Because I think they expected that it would be out by the end of the year, and I just can't do it. But it'll be out not long after that.
Well, it sounds like you know what you want to say, and you've got your finger on that discussion. So thanks very much for sharing that with us. I'm glad our listeners will know about the upcoming book and that you're able to talk about the middle class, something that's just, you know, we're going to have to talk about that again. We're going to have to see more articles and stuff coming out. And there is a myth, as you pointed out, and that myth needs to be busted. So thanks for contributing to that, and thanks for being on the program with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Brendan, and thank you for inviting me.